Hey guys, this is Ishai Breslauer and welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. On Mondays, we dive deep into an asset class, and on Thursdays, we go into some inspirational stories for the weekend. Can't wait to start. Let's go. Hi guys, how are you? This is Ishai Breslauer, the CRE Shark Eye Show. I hope you guys are doing fantastic today. And today we have a guest, a special guest. His name is Greg Haft. Greg Haft is an old friend, I would call it. And he's a veteran, a business veteran. And today, a super active in anything, meaning whether it's from the investing end, the sponsor end, or the broker end, he will tell us all about it, all what's going on in New York City and everything around it. So we have the privilege of having him. Greg, how are you?
I'm fine, Ishai. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being on the show. And the first thing I want to ask is, we know each other for a long time. And what I want to start with is how, because I know you did a lot of stuff, what got you into the real estate realm?
I've always had a passion for real estate. Regardless of what business I was in, real estate was always the asset class that we would acquire with cash flows from the other businesses. And as things evolved, real estate went from being my stepchild to being having my primary focus.
That's amazing. Tell me something. So today you are in real estate. Today you got into it. Today you're in it. Which asset class you mostly deal with?
So the primary asset class is multifamily and mixed use. I also do land deals for developers. New York right now, because of the nature of the depressed real estate values, there are a lot of distressed new development condo projects that are selling at deep discounts. So that's getting a lot of my focus and time and attention these days.
Right. So let's go back. We're going to have a lot to talk about today, because we're going to speak about those distressed assets and what's going on really out there. But let's start with the simplicity, right? Let's start with a multifamily. Okay. What type of multifamily mostly is your scope? Meaning sizes, type of deals, type of stuff, type of clients, who mostly are the people that you deal with?
So I am not a mass marketing broker. I am an investor myself. I deal with an exclusive client base of 20 to 25 groups made up of very deep-pocketed family offices and several funds. That makes up the majority of my business.
I got it. And what type of assets, meaning what type of multifamily assets in terms of size?
So I have buyers pretty much at all levels, but my sweet spot is 20 to 50 units and 15 to 50 million. Right. I do come across the $100-150 million deal, and I do come across the $5 million deal, but that's really my sweet spot.
Okay, so what I want to know is, we're going to talk about this whole COVID thing in a second, but before we get to that, could you tell us a little bit about the differences? Because you are in the New York, you're not only doing Manhattan, is that correct?
Correct.
So can you tell us a little bit about the differences between the boroughs, you know, and how you deal with that?
So these are very unusual times, because historically, Manhattan led all trends, and the outer boroughs, mostly Brooklyn, some select parts of Queens, like Long Island City and Astoria, would track Manhattan's trends by about 6 months.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about this. Let's say we are now pre-COVID, okay? there's no COVID. Okay, let's make believe. What is going on in the market pre-COVID, Manhattan versus the boroughs? Okay, so I understand they're trailing. Can you talk a little bit about the types of deals, valuations, the size, the scope?
So the challenge was back in June 2019 when New York became subject to a total overhaul of rent policy. And the government basically started capping rent increases and started eliminating all of the ways that savvy investors could get rent levels up. And if it becomes more difficult to get rents up, then it becomes more difficult to have growing and increasing NOIs. And if your NOIs aren't increasing, your asset values aren't increasing. So we were starting in New York with a handicap even prior to COVID.
Right, but when you look at you look at that situation, we all remember that that was the talk, right? Rent regulations, what happened, that was the main talk. Every event you went, this is what everybody spoke about. What was the solution back then to make a positive NOI when there were trouble? Okay, let's talk about back there solution because I want to compare it to the post.
So there weren't a lot of options. And I even have a fair amount of clients who shifted their attention away from New York and to what we refer to as the friendly states, Texas, Tennessee, Florida, right, where they are much more investor friendly, and the laws,
right, landlord, right,
the laws are not as anti-landlord as they were trending in New York.
Right.
That being said, New York City is, from a real estate standpoint, the most resilient market in the world. And if it could recover from the likes of 9/11, it can recover from the likes of anything.
Okay, so we'll get to that right now. So here's the difference. First of all, before we get to that, what differentiates in terms of the types of multifamily assets? New York, Brooklyn, Queens. If I have to, like, if I'm an investor and I'm coming in and there's no COVID yet, okay, and I'm looking at those assets, what type of assets will I find in New York City versus the types that I'll find in Brooklyn in terms of their sizes, their capitalization, in terms of their vacancies? What should I find prior to COVID? I would like to go into that comparison.
The primary differences were in the way of price point, but each of the markets have a certain amount of free market units,
right,
have a decent amount of rent stabilized units and regulated units. So it's not like Manhattan has a higher percentage of free market than Brooklyn does. Of all of the five boroughs, Manhattan and Brooklyn and Queens and Staten Island and the Bronx all have similar assets. They all have multifamily assets that are free market. They have multifamily assets that are rent stabilized, and they have assets that have a combination of both.
Hey guys, before we continue, I would like to introduce you to the 7-day CRE challenge, which will introduce you to commercial real estate and will show you that anyone can do this. Also, I have the free cheat sheet for commercial real estate with the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. You can download it free. Just click below or above, wherever it is, and get it. Let's continue. Okay, so now we're stepping into March last year, which has been, it's crazy, but it's been a year. Can you believe that? It's crazy. And We're stepping into that and we're asking ourselves, okay, what happened? And you are in New York. You live in New York. What, before we get into the real estate aspect of it, what did you feel about it family-wise and business-wise, what's happening in the world? What did you feel in the beginning?
So obviously these are uncharted waters and unprecedented times. Real estate was not considered by the government to be essential. So when New York was on lockdown, basically the real estate market was frozen, right, almost to the point of paralysis. What started happening was the government started giving tenants the rights and abilities not to pay their rents without recourse. There was an inability to foreclose. There was an inability to evict. Some people had true hardships and actually couldn't afford to pay their rents. Others just took advantage of the situation. But in any event, if you're an investor and you own a property and your rents aren't coming in, what are you to do? And how are you going to service your debt?
Right. That's what everybody talks about. We had a couple of shows with people who had actually experienced it. And what I want to ask you is, once you found out this is what's going on, like we're going to 3-4 months into the COVID, where is Greg? What do you do? How do you pivot? How did you react to that thing, especially being in New York City?
So I surround myself with some incredible professionals. And we made certain strategic decisions. I was watching a lot of other brokers who basically felt that, okay, well, the government isn't allowing us to run our businesses. We're not allowed to show properties. We're not allowed to have meetings, and treated them almost as if it was one long extended vacation. I, on the other hand, took the opportunity to clean up my CRM. I made sure that I spoke with every client that I had at least once a month. I kept in touch with them, and we discussed what our post-lockdown strategies were going to be, what assets we were going to target, so that as soon as we were able to, we were going to be ready to be up and running and not have the startup curve that most other brokers were experiencing.
I got it. But which assets, when you had those talks, those meetings, those discussions with your colleagues, where did you see yourself going? You said, okay, we don't want to be at that startup point and we want to be much further when everything opens up in a way, right? Because nothing still opened up, but eventually people started doing transactions. At that point, what did you guys really set to yourselves? We're going to go for that asset class. We're going to do those type of deals. What did you guys say to yourself?
So we went asset class by asset class by asset class. And we discussed the issues of office as an example. And we discussed whether work at home was something that was going to continue. Was it a trend that was going to continue post-COVID? Were companies going to need less office space? Were companies going to downsize? Were consumer product companies going to now shut their showrooms because they saw that they were able to run their business via Zoom meetings? And then was the talk of retail. Where was retail going to come back? what neighborhoods were going to recover more quickly than others. And then, of course, hospitality had its own conversation because hotels were basically shut down. The question was, how many are shut down for good? What we did decide was that multifamily and mixed use were the healthiest of the food groups.
Right, and that's true. And big question is, okay, so you decided, it's clear from this, from what you said, and it's clear from what pretty much everyone who is in the market said, that the healthiest, most resilient asset class is multifamily, right? And that's what everybody went to. And so you guys probably decided, okay, we're going to multifamily. Within multifamily, and when you decided to go back out in action, what type of deals you found and what type of action you guys took?
So we are still in a mode right now of getting back on our feet. Transactions are down over 50%, and the majority of commercial brokers had fewer than 4 closings in the entire 2020. The problem,
talking about the average broker.
Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Many that I know had none. The problem is that there, to this day, is an enormous gap between the new values of the assets and the sellers being in denial of how much the value of their properties have decreased.
Okay, so let's talk about this for a second. Because I hear that a lot, because that I heard from people who are already in the business, who own a lot of multifamily, and everybody's saying, not everybody, but many people are saying, okay, so people don't want to sell. Some say what you just said, they're in denial. And some people say, because the real value is determined only when a real transaction happens, right? Or when the bank comes and actually checks out what type of NOI there is. But at this point, with a forbearance, with rents that are not coming in because people are allowed not to pay rent or whatever is going on, the real value cannot be determined. That's a fact. Do you think it's true?
I disagree.
Okay.
Whether or not things are transacting does not change what a given value is. And I think that it's very simplistic and almost goes back to 8th grade math. For the sake of example,
I like that thought. Okay, go ahead.
For the sake of example, let's say that a particular investor pre-COVID had a 5.5 cap requirement, and in COVID has a 5.5 cap requirement. Now, that cap needs to tie back to an NOI. If pre-COVID vacancy reserve assumptions were 3%, now they're 6%. Pre-COVID financial statements did not include collection loss provisions. Now they do, of at least 10%. Pre-rent regulation change, you didn't expense your capital expenditures because they were your vehicle to raise rents. Now that they're not, you need to expense them. So all of these changes, taken the same property, if you were to calculate their NOI now compared to 18 months ago, your NOI would be 30% lower. So if your 5.5 cap is now based on an NOI that's 30% lower than the NOI of 18 months ago.
I agree with that.
If A equal B and B equals C, then A equals C.
Right. But a lot of people, yeah, so I agree with that. I agree with the fact that if your analysis or your approach is a cap approach, okay, that's my cap. That's where I'm going for. So I agree with you. It's true. But if you are, a full circle approach, okay, and you're looking at the cap and you're looking at the type of vacancies, and that counts in your world and that counts in your thought. Also, the financing has to count, and the way that the banks are treating today are, meaning what is, let's ask you, what is your experience from a financing end?
So it's interesting that you asked that question, because I have modified how my team goes about searching for inventory. And unlike in the past, the first thing that we do is identify properties where owners are a minimum of 60 days delinquent. Once those are identified, then we take a view on how much equity is there in the underlying asset. In hopes of identifying assets where owners, while they're looking at much lower values, can receive offers that will enable them to pay off their debt and give their equity some return. It's not so easy, because in many cases, the owners are over-leveraged. And they have no incentive whatsoever to accept an offer that's deficient of their loan level.
That's amazing. But the one thing that is a question, within the banks, I would say, the financial systems, thought process or belief system, call it whatever you want. Did the LTV in their belief system or in the way they do business changed? Meaning they require different or?
Incredibly different.
How?
In the past, if you couldn't sell your asset for the price you felt was reasonable, your fallback was to refinance. Well, if the lenders are now at 65% LTVs, where they used to be at 80, refinancing means you need to come to the table with more equity.
Right.
Most people don't have that additional.
That's a lot of money
to the table.
That's a lot of money. That percentage is huge.
So now that takes refinance as a fallback option off the table. Then on top of that, let's talk just for a second about new development. In the past, when you were getting towards the end of your construction loan, you would convert into an inventory loan, which would give you 2 to 3 years to sell off your condo units. Lenders.
Unless you start a pre-sale, right.
Lenders, because of the slow and low sales velocity, are not issuing inventory loans at high LTVs. So I'm actually working on deals with developers who are currently not in default. They're still in their construction loan phase, yet they're writing their equity down in an effort to try and sell their property at a high enough amount to pay off their construction debt.
That's crazy. That's gonna that potentially can shake the market tremendously, and we could have a lot of
the difficulty with that is if new development values come down, then it's going to have a ripple effect on multifamily. Because if you can buy new development at $1,200 a foot,
yeah, pennies on the dollar. Exactly.
Why would you pay $1,800 a foot for a multifamily property?
Let me ask you this. From what you see out there, is there an Armageddon when it comes to those condo developments that need to sell? And if so, where? And if not, in your world, in the world of NYC versus Brooklyn, Queens, et cetera, and are there areas that it's not happening? That means that there are sales going on and we see that that they are successful, et cetera. Before we get into a discussion of new development that might come, you know, into the market, I'm talking about those who are already there. What's going on with that?
So of the five boroughs of New York City, Manhattan has gotten hit the hardest. Values are down anywhere from 25 to 40%.
That's amazing.
Pricing.
Not in a good way, yeah.
Pricing on condos that were just built are trading at 35% below the estimated sale price in their Schedule A's. Mezzanine lenders are starting to foreclose. As they step into the shoes of their borrowers, they don't care about the equity anymore. They just care about the recovery of the senior lender's debt and their debt. The lenders are going to be resetting the values.
So according to that, what is the future for new developments in the city? And is there a future, or they're all just, you know, where there is a development coming up or for sale, meaning a land to develop or a building to be, you know, demo or something that is coming up, a deal like that. Is there any of those, or they're all on hold?
Manhattan is frozen. It's got hit the hardest.
Right.
And there is probably 2 to 4 years worth of existing inventory.
That's amazing. That's incredible. That's very sad.
Brooklyn yeah. is not nearly as bad shape as Manhattan is.
Do you know areas a little bit? Which ones are in better shape? Which are, would you be able to share with from your
network? You have the better parts of Brooklyn, the downtown Brooklyn's, the Brooklyn Heights, the Park Slopes. Those are always excellent performers. And the gentrifying areas like Bed-Stuy and Bushwick, to name just a few, yeah, are also very strong.
I got it. So Brooklyn is performing. What about Queens? Because I hear mixed things about Queens. I hear people who are doing okay, and I hear people who, just the same as in the city, that are just you know, waiting to cut the losses.
Astoria and Long Island City are the healthiest areas in Queens. But they are not without their share of headaches. The only difference is there's less inventory, so there will be developments starting up in those areas, where in Manhattan, I don't expect us to see any.
I got it. So the rule is, according to you, the rule of thumb, and that's what I think also, I agree with you, but the rule of thumb is that whatever's closer to the city, that's funny enough, the city's in trouble, but those neighborhoods that are closer to the city are actually doing better. So that is funny, but it's sad at the same time. Let me ask you this before we close. What is the future of, meaning in New York in general, pretty much we know, and there are a lot of discussions, but Manhattan is a focus of, I would say, distress and disaster, I would say even. And a lot of people are talking about a market crash right coming up, meaning we're not, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know. But, you know, you hear Ray Dalio saying it, and you hear all kind of people doing, making moves out of the, you know, the finance market. Stock market is like all-time high. And again, and the valuations of companies are, you know, everything is high. Office buildings in Manhattan are being deserted. Where are we going?
Manhattan is always going to be the center of the universe. And Manhattan has proven to be the most resilient place on earth.
Okay, whether so that's a positive back, note, but the facts are facts, and you stated the facts. So when are we going, having Manhattan back in action?
After 9/11, people said downtown Manhattan real estate is dead forever. And no developer is going to develop higher than 25 stories anymore. Only 3 years later, downtown Manhattan became the most expensive neighborhoods in Manhattan. And every place you turn are 60, 70, and 80 story buildings. If Manhattan recovered from 9/11 and Manhattan recovered from 2008, 2009, once we get beyond COVID with the vaccinations and the theaters are open again and the museums are open again and the business centers are open again, you're going to see a full and complete recovery of the city.
So let me challenge that. And knowing a little country in the world called Israel, and which is considered to be also by Bloomberg one of the most vaccinated countries in the world right now. And things are not opening up as fast, not at all. And that's a pretty much a good model to know that, first of all, yes, the vaccine is important. Everybody should get, you know, vaccinated to get the shots, everybody. But it still will take time until everybody gets it, until all these mutants, all those changes are happening in the world with the COVID. And it will take time. And we have in this city, I would say, a number of challenges, in my opinion. I agree with you that the city will be back. New York City is New York City. It will be back. I know that. Meaning everyone who has some, I would say, good vision thinks that. The question is when. And the when question is huge because on one hand, you have the real estate aspect. Then you have the financial aspect. Then you have the pandemic aspect. But there's another aspect that could make it crazy, and that is the policy aspect, okay? Whoever's running this city, I'm not talking politics in this show, but I'm saying it's just a fact of life that the city has become less landlord, you know, how do you say, they don't favor landlords, and right now we don't know what's going to happen. So that could
lower. There are many investors who acknowledge that the current political environment, the progressive environment, is not landlord friendly. But like everything else, it's a pendulum that will swing back the other way. When the policies don't work, people will look for different policy. And there are people that are not only gobbling up free market in Manhattan, they're even gobbling up rent stabilized Manhattan because they don't believe that these stabilized laws will be in effect 3 to 5 years from now.
I got it. So last thing before we part, how long, when is Manhattan back in action? Year two, three, four? From your perspective,
3 years from now, we're going to be talking about this like it was one bad dream.
All right. I hope from your mouth to God, as we say. All right. Greg Haft, thank you so much for being with us. And to everybody,
thank you for
I say,
me.
For sure. And for everybody, I say, look around wherever you are. If you're on YouTube, you're LinkedIn, you are on the podcast, you're listening it on in audio. Look in the links. Greg, you're going to leave me the links. And obviously, you guys are going to see all posted up all around us. So you can contact him as per your investments in terms of your endeavors towards New York, New York City. And obviously, as Greg said, he's a very boutique type of a broker and an investor. So if you guys are serious and you are serious about this, definitely you can contact the emails below. All right, Greg, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Yishai. Okay.
No problem. Stick around for a second as I close the show. Guys, I just want to make sure that whoever's listening and is a beginner or towards being a beginner, you're in the very beginning of commercial real estate, check out the 7-day CRE challenge that I have and the courses that I have in the links below or above. And with that, I'm going to see you next time. You guys take care of yourselves. Hey guys, thanks for joining me in this CRE Shark Eye show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.